Good evening. On behalf of Powell's, I'd like to welcome you to Baghdad. We're very pleased tonight to welcome Barbara Ehrenreich. Last time Barbara was here with Nickel and Dime, we held the event across the street at Powell's, and of course it was one of the biggest turnouts we've ever had. So tonight we thought we would do it right. I'd like to thank the folks here at Baghdad for being so hospitable and great to work with once again. Barbara Ehrenreich, as most of you know, is the author of 13 books, including the New York Times bestseller Nickel and Dimed. She's a frequent contributor to Harper and The Nation and has been a columnist at the New York Times and Time magazine. Tonight she'll be reading from and talking about her new book, Bait and Switch, The Futile Pursuit of the American Dream. Barbara will talk for about 20 minutes and then she'll take questions. Those of you who have questions, if you'd be willing to come down to the front of either aisle here. That would simplify things because we don't have a traveling microphone available to us. And then once the question and answer is over, books will be on sale out the back door there. I'm sure you're already aware of where that is. And the signing will take place up the ramp behind the cash registers there. We'll only have time tonight for signatures only, so there won't be any personalizing of books. So once again, thank you all for coming, and thank you, Barbara.
Wait a minute. Can we have a little more house lights? I want to see if there's anybody here. Help? Lights? Anybody out there? Yeah, a few of you. Okay. I first want to say it's a delight to be back in Portland very briefly, but I went to college here at Reed quite a while ago, and where I learned nothing of usefulness for the corporate world, I am proud to say. Great school. And I also want to say hi to Nell and Marcia. Are you here? Nell and Marcia? Okay, that's my aunt and my cousin, and I'm sorry to just see you at this distance. Anyway, let me tell you why I went into the work that led to this book, Bait and Switch. As a result of writing Nickel and Dimed, I got tons of letters from people in really terrible situations, people who had gotten an eviction notice, people who had just gotten a diagnosis of cancer and had no health insurance, that sort of thing. And I began to notice a couple of years ago that a lot of these letters were coming from people who had college degrees, even master's degrees, and who had once held what they thought were secure white-collar jobs, and had somehow fallen all the way down to the low wage, to the poverty level. As I read about it, I found there's a lot of churning that goes on in the white-collar corporate world. This is no longer, you know, this is not the 1950s or the 1960s where people got a job and then sort of gradually rose in the company and retired with a pension. And maybe it was boring, but they did get paid. Today, it's a whole other story. Richard Sennett, the sociologist, estimates that you might have 11 jobs after college, and those are not all voluntary changes by any means. So I wanted to investigate, because it seemed to me this is a side of poverty that I had not really considered. So I decided to do it the way I had done Nickel and Dime, that is to put myself physically in the situation. And I had to really go undercover this time. Changed my name, because I was afraid the regular name might discourage some corporate hiring managers. And I resolved to do everything possible to get a job. I presented myself as a PR person. I had a fake resume. And then I sought out all possible forms of help. Fortunately or unfortunately, there is a lot of help out there now. Since the mid-1990s, a whole transition industry, it's called, has sprung up to help or, depending on your point of view, prey on the white-collar unemployed. So that's what I stepped out into, and I didn't know what was going to be like. It was through the looking glass from the beginning. I don't know about you, but I'm a journalist. I was trained and educated in science. So I consider myself part of that reality-based community that our administration doesn't like too much in Washington. You know what I mean? You know, reality, that kind of thing. And so here I was, my first career coach, but they all want to give you a personality test. I don't know why. You know, in the blue-collar world, a nickel and dime, yeah, there are personality tests. I can remember one question that I often encountered. It was, agree or disagree, it is easier to work when you're a little bit high. Very tricky. Amos got me on that one. But now, you know, in the white-collar world, they really want to probe the depths of your personality. The corporations as well as these career coaches. And, you know, it takes a while to answer these questions. I couldn't figure out how to answer most of them, frankly. Anyway, I, you know, quickly went through the Enneagram test was one of them. And my coach said, this is what he said, what he divined about my personality as a result of this. He said, I'm good and loving. That's nice. But also melancholy and envious. And some reason, you know, there's a lot of angles and triangles and circles with this Enneagram thing. And it says, bottom line, I should not be in an occupation that requires much writing. It's hard, you know, to find out after all these years I've been wasting my time. But anyway, this is the transition industry. I'm going to read you. The other part, big part is networking, of course. By this time I had paid a coach to perfect my resume with me. This is a very interesting process, perfecting your resume. You can't give your age away in a resume. In fact, you have to slice off any experience before 10 years ago, or it might appear that you were possibly over 35 and, you know, unemployable. It would be nice to have more light if I'm going to read a little part, a little light. No? Not it. Okay. Let's see. What does it say here? I've gone to a networking. Oh, not on me. Thank you. No. Light's on the page. Okay. This is a networking group for laid off, downsized, reorged, outsourced, et cetera, white-collar folks that I attended in Washington, D.C. And this was a relatively good one, as these events go, because it was, for one thing, secular. I found that an awful lot of the networking business has been being taken over by evangelical Christian groups who really just want to proselytize. Anyway, we have a speaker today at this event. His name is Joe. And he asks us what obstacles we face in our job searches. A half dozen hands go up, offering such obstacles as fear, inertia, embarrassment, procrastination, lack of money, quote, nonlinear career path, and the mysterious challenge of, quote, staying up. Joe, our leader, is doing his best to keep up with all of this on a flip chart. I throw in that I get overwhelmed by all the things there are to do and lack priorities. And I'm really thinking at that point, you know, about using the internet, using all the job boards. I'm having a hard time with that. At this point, I am expecting some solutions from Joe. He says, what have other people here done to manage, to solve these problems? I want his job is what I'm thinking, which seems to amount to no more than note-taking and serving in his brilliant red sweater as a human stoplight. But solutions to my problems of, quote, scheduling are pouring in as fast as I can write them down. Quote, I make a daily schedule including internet searches and exercise, one woman contributes. Quote, this forces me to be accountable even if I'm only the only one in the room managing myself. Someone else adds, I set the alarm for the same time I did when I had a job. I get dressed, I shave, I get dressed up for work, just as if I were going to work. Another solution, enroll your spouse as a supervisor to remind you what you said you were going to accomplish that day in your job search. That is a marriage that is not going to last. But anyway, this advice comes to me as a surprise. Job searching is not joblessness. It is a job in itself and should be structured to resemble one right down to the more regrettable features of employment, like having to follow orders, orders which in this case are self-generated. Everyone seems to agree on the necessity of managing oneself as just as a real boss might, although this presents immediate conceptual problems. If selling myself and my new career coach, replacing the Enneagram guy, she's constantly telling me, you've got to sell yourself. You've got to brand yourself and take that out, that self out, and sell it. If selling myself had seemed like a tricky form of self-objectification, managing myself takes the process even farther into the realm of mental cloning. I picture the Barbaras splitting off into worker Barbara, the one who sits at the computer and searches for jobs, product Barbara, the one who has to be sold, and now manager Barbara, whose responsibility is to oversee the other two, all contending for dominance in the same cramped office space. Now, I just have to comment on this business of networking. You think about what that means, because this is the basic message of so many of the coaches and everything. It means it doesn't matter who you are, what you can do. To get a job, it matters who you know. That's the basic theme here. And I finally understood what's wrong with that just last week. When you have jobs that depend on who you know, how good you look, whether you have a good attitude and so on, you get Michael D. Brown in charge of FEMA. You know, that's what's going on. And I should just say something about the philosophy that you keep hearing from the group leaders and the coaches and everything is a victim-blaming philosophy. And you'll get it in the business advice books, too. Because the idea is everything depends on you and your attitude. That's why they're so interested in the personality aspect. You have to have a certain personality, in fact, upbeat, cheery, positive. And you know, there's even a scientific explanation they give you for this. And that I'll explain to you, even though I know you're not scientists, all of you. But when you beam thoughts out into the universe, the universe is like a big mail order house and it beams back what you want. You can get whatever you want by thinking positively about it. Now, of course, there are medications for people who believe that. But the trouble is, this is something that is being told to people who have really hit rock bottom in many cases, who've lost their job, you know, lost their insurance, maybe selling their house, in the downward trajectory I talked about when I mentioned those letters at the beginning. But that's what you hear all the time in the business world and in the fringes of it that I was dwelling on. I will give you one more bit of my experience here, if I can read it. I've put my resume out. I've applied for hundreds of jobs. Getting like zero response whatsoever from these internet applications. I've been networking like a fiend. I decide I need an upgrade. I decide the product, Barbara, isn't good enough. I decide I have to upgrade the product and then take that out into the market again. So I go for a makeover. I pay $250 to be made over as a corporate person. I don't know, from what I can see of this audience. Well, I'll be available for individual consultations later, but you are not ready to market yourselves. which is what I like, one of the things I like about Portland and Powell's, anyway. Anyway, so if I go to this guy, image management person, and I explain, you know, that I'm new to the corporate world and I need some help on my appearance. And just as I would prepare for a visit to the dental hygienist with extra brushing and flossing, I have put on unusual effort into my appearance today. Mascara as well as eyeliner, lipstick enhanced with gloss, jackets and slacks, tailored pink shirt, scarf. Only now, as I await my consultation, do I begin to see the multiple defects in my ensemble emerging. My pants socks, which I had taken to be black in the gloom of the hotel room, are actually navy blue, although my jacket is black. My watch cost $15 19 years ago, and the band no longer matches the face. Then there is a serious problem here with the slacks, which I had gotten at the sales rack on the Gap. I noticed for the first time that the zipper doesn't come all the way up, so I, you know, have to keep that covered up. And then there are the earrings, which cost $3. Anyway, now I get my instructions. I Prescott, as I call him in this book, congratulates me for coming to him for this consultation because he says some people neglect the visuals. So here we go. He explains to me why it is you have to conform precisely to fit into the corporate culture in the way you appear, as well as that perky attitude. And that is, you want to show you're a team player. That sounds good, doesn't it? You know, like you're joining a team, you got to wear the uniform exactly. So here I am, and he advises, in fact, that I should, before I show up for an interview at a corporation, I should call the receptionist and ask her to tell me what the power gals are wearing, which sounds like a good idea, unless, of course, it occurs to me the receptionist hates the power gals and maliciously advises me to show up in harem pants and bustier. Now we proceed to the material at hand, which is me. As in so many of my coaching experiences so far, we begin by categorizing me as a type. He says I am angular in shape, which is good. My face is shaped like a diamond, which doesn't sound too good to me. It sounds like a pointy head. But in fact refers to my cheekbones. They are wonderful, he says. I can keep them. My hair, et cetera, pass muster. And he says, you know, but then, you know, after all these good things, he explains to me that there is a big problem. I come across as, quote, too authoritative. And the reason for that is that I have too many straight lines. This is not good. These straight lines, got to have curved lines if you're a woman to suggest accessibility, he says. See, it's different for a woman. For a man, can the same uniform, all men have to wear the same uniform. They can screw it up, I guess, with the wrong shirt color. But women, you can't be too feminine. You certainly can't be sexy. I'm not too afraid. You know, that's not like a big danger here. But on the other, I thought you're supposed to be kind of masculine, but, you know, I think if you go a little too far with these straight lines, the guys think you're mocking them. You know, you got to soften that a little bit. So we go through all of this, and then he says, as for your body language, the way you're holding your hand on your waist, you seem to be holding something in. That's the zipper problem. But you can see, it is a big job, getting a corporate job. I will not give away the plot, well, unless you ask, to tell you what happened. But you can see I'm here now, not in a cubicle somewhere. And a lot of it was funny in a surreal kind of way. But the story itself is sad. You know, I began to understand how that downward spiral happens to lead to people facing eviction notices and the other kind of crises that I hear from people often in. And, you know, there's some real catch-22s along the way. One of them, which I had never thought of, is it if you lose your health insurance, and in our insane system, health insurance is attached to a job, even though your job is going to change all the time. But if you lose your health, when you lose your health insurance, you probably are going to damage your credit rating, right? Because you're going to encounter some medical bills, especially because you're likely to be depressed and stressed out in this condition. Now, more and more employers, 37% today, want a perfect credit rating as a condition of employment, which is catch-22. Another thing, and this is a real disaster, is that the longer you're unemployed, the less likely you are to be hired. You know why? Because now you've got a gap in your resume. This morning, the New York Times had an article you might have seen about young Ivy League women who intend to take out 10 years from their careers for raising children. You know, I tried that on one coach. I said, I've got a gap in my resume because I raised children. And he said, well, you better have a pretty good story to explain that. You know, there's no return. Anyway, the slide to poverty can be quite rapid. And when I say that, I mean, you know, people end up going to Circuit City or to Walmart, working for $7, $8 an hour, and are very likely stuck there. So I think this is another side of poverty in America. And one reason I think it's important to emphasize it is not just because of the plight of the white-collar people in these situations, but because I want middle and upper middle class people to understand that the poor aren't someone else, those people, different from them, but that in fact a huge vulnerability hangs over every one of us, and we've got to unite to figure out ways to change the situation. So let me stop there and have some discussion. And now, could we have the lights? No. is there a way to communicate with them? Yeah, okay. What are some of my... Oh, no, not light on me. Light on them. What are some of my favorite resources for people trying to make change? Well, good question. In terms of, you know, those in low-wage jobs now, I think groups like ACORN, very important. Jobs with Justice. Is there a Jobs with Justice chapter? Okay. Anybody here from Jobs with Justice? What's your name? Barbara. Okay. Margaret. Oh, I was just hoping you were Barbara. But Margaret, will you, when I'm signing books, will you come into the, you know, sit near me in case some people want to meet you and give you their addresses or email addresses?
Sure.
Okay, good. And those are good groups. There are unions also, like the SEIU, that are reaching out to a lot of low-paid service workers. Sir, SEIU, and your name?
Shirley.
Shirley, will you come and sit with me, too, afterwards? Very good. Thank you, Shirley. So I'll want you to come and meet Shirley afterwards when I'm signing books, too. It's outsourcing is part of it. But the other part is a seismic change in corporate culture that happened between the late 80s and now, when at a certain point they decided that employees were not assets, they were expenses. Now, they shed the blue-collar people in the 80s when they outsourced manufacturing. Now, you know, in the 90s and in our century, it is the white-collar people, too. There is a fad for getting leaner and leaner. And the flip side of the people on the street searching for jobs is the people who have jobs but are now doing the work of two people. And that's not possible. So we have to make changes. Now, you asked about more resources. It gives me a chance to mention my website, which is somewhat embarrassingly entitled BarbaraErenreich.com. It's nice and slick, though. The publisher made it, created it. And I will be posting more resources as I come across them and trying to use events like this and the website to bring people together to talk about what to do locally. Yes, sir. I don't know. I wondered. But I think, you know, possibly it is something, you know, that people do, you know, in trying to pull themselves back up. But it would be an interesting thing to research. Even if you're a Republican, I bet you could do a good, you know, piece of research on it. He overtips? Good. There's no such thing as overtipping, remember. Uh-huh. What? Okay. Okay,
and
they can't hear.
The other thing I do is I also leave a gratuity for the house.
Hotel housekeeper, very good. Yes, don't forget. I think tipping is undignified. I don't like it. I think there should be adequate pay. But since we don't have adequate pay, you have to remember when you tip a server or a housekeeper, that's their wage. That's pretty much their wage. So don't forget, never forget that. Yeah. More comments, questions? This is what it's a problem. I can't see.
I recently read a book called The End of Work, and they talk about the trend is not just outsourcing, but roboticizing everything. So as you all go shopping for Fred Meyer or any place else, Home Depot, of course, we've all noticed that they want, but they're starting to corral you to this self-service. They want to
How do I fight the trend toward robotizing various service jobs like that self-checkout kind of thing in the supermarket? I don't know, but we have somebody from the SEIU here who will explain that right at the table later, how we do that. But it's part of this new corporate idea that humans are a nuisance. I mean, that seems to be what it amounts to. Yes. Wait, you're right here.
Yeah,
you come right up.
I'll recap what I said a moment ago, which is that I want to thank this woman for telling the truth. Which, unfortunately, in our nation has become a rarity. And I think we better take some action before it's gone entirely. But the question that just came up in my mind is often when I talk with my friends who are people from the 60s, we're in a state of rage. We can't understand why Americans are falling for the lines that we're being fed. And I often try to rise to the defense of the common person because I myself am a common person. And I go back to what it means to be a citizen. And I think most of us are ground down from our work days, and therefore there's nothing left to consider what it means to be a citizen in our culture. And what I thought when I heard you in the last few minutes and everything that was coming up is that in this country, in order for us to rise up and take the country back, we need to understand that being a citizen and being a worker are really part of the same whole, and you cannot just be a worker and you cannot just be a citizen. You have to realize that to be a full human being, you have to use both sides of that human being, and the times are urgent. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you very much. You know, Shirley asked this question to, you know, raised the issue to why don't people rebel more? And that was one of the questions I started my research with. If there is so much, especially long-term unemployment among white-collar people, why don't we hear some protest? And I think it has a lot to do with that ideology I talked about, which is endemic not only to the corporate world but to our culture, which is that you are responsible for your own fate only. How many of you read Who Moved My Cheese? Ah, you know, corporations give this book out to their employees. And to summarize the story, because I finally sat down and read it cover to cover, it says you're going to be jerked around all your life. Just grin and bear it. That's what it says. We're hearing that all the time. And we're hearing all the time that when you express anger, there's something wrong with you. No, there's something wrong with you when you don't express anger. I want to, okay, yes, sir, you're so close, you can come up, take the.
My question is, why don't we consider using a little bit more of the European model, where we invest in the people a little bit more, have better health care, have a situation where we consider that we don't want large portions of the population in utter poverty, where they're scratching and trying to steal each other's 10-cent biscuits, where we assume that people should have good jobs, they should have. We can't become Europe, but why don't we adopt more of that? And what do you think about the Republican answer to that, which says that Europe is going downhill and their economies are all over and we're the only thing that's yet left in the economy in the world?
Well, one answer to that conservative point, is Finland. Finland has the strongest welfare state of the Western world, the greatest protections, strong unions, and it is also has a productivity level the same or greater than from year to year as the United States. Then they've decided that people are an asset. Educated, healthy people are an asset. And it's a capitalist economy. You know, this is within capitalism. They've decided that, and they do much, much better. But, you know, if I could propose a very minimal agenda that we could be focusing on. One, universal health insurance. Is that so hard? That's, you know, way overdue. Two, we have to have adequate financial support for people who are out of work. And the present unemployment insurance scheme does not do it at all. It's too brief. It's too inadequate. I would say we need a system of cash supports that embraces not only those who don't have a job at the moment, but those who can't work because they already have a job, like taking care of small children or elderly parents. Now, we used to call that welfare. We could call it something else. But other countries acknowledge that there is a need for a safety net for everybody. And thirdly, and these are not radical points, our government constantly gives corporations tax breaks and subsidies in the name of job creation. One of these big tax breaks or giveaways is called the American Jobs Creation Act of 2005. It is going to result in something like an $8 billion tax break for Hewlett-Packard, which has just announced layoffs of 14,500 people. That's not job creation. That's job destruction. Now, where are the politicians who can stand up to the corporations and say, no, we're not coddling you anymore in the name of jobs? You have to start being accountable to people. Oh, yes.
One last question for this young woman right here.
Ooh, okay. Yes.
Okay. Well, I guess I was just going to make the point that the remedies you suggested are political remedies, and yet I don't know how political figures articulate a policy agenda when you have to admit the death of the American dream or at least the fading of the American dream. It seems politically impossible to talk to the average American and suggest that that dream is gone. And yet it's also politically impossible to make change without making that admission. So it's a very hard kind of place to find a voice in. And how can progressive politicians articulate a way out without also disrupting people's sense of hope about what it is to have American identity?
Mm-hmm. Well, I got a call just since this book came out from a middle-aged, laid-off, white-collar guy. And he said something which stuck in my mind. He said, "My citizenship doesn't mean anything." Now that, I think, was a painful thing for him to say, just as it's a hard thing to hear. But a lot of people have lost hope unless we give them hope through our efforts to make change. Hope isn't just something that you keep alive in yourself individually, but that we, you know, nourish among each other. Let me, you know, wind up this way. How many people here are looking for a job right now or have a job that they'd really like to get out of and get another one? How many people? All right, can't be everybody. Okay, that's a lot of people. Now, I am going to ask somebody here, or a couple of people, to be organizers. And I'm going to ask people who are in this situation to leave their email addresses with those people willing to be organizers and form a group right here in Portland. No nonsense, none of that crap about, you know, victim blaming or anything like that. But how do we advocate for change around these issues? Where are the people who will be the leaders? Before I appoint you. Come on, put up your hands or you'll be... You? You? All right, here's one and there's two. And your first names? Fran? And Dan. That's great. Fran and Dan. Okay. So Fran and Dan, are you also going to come and sit with me now and we'll get a long sheet of paper, get those email addresses, and get people together in some form to use their creativity and skills and education and everything on the urgent problem of taking America back. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Barbara. Thank you all for coming, and if you give Barbara just a couple minutes to get to the table up above there, the signing will begin. Thanks again. We're very pleased to welcome Barbara Ehrenreich. You may know Barbara from her articles in Time, Harper's Magazine, The Nation, and many others, or from her books covering a wide variety of topics, including The Worst Years of Our Lives, Witches, Nurses, and Midwives, Fear of Falling, Blood Rights, and many others. Tonight, Barbara will be reading from and talking about her new book, Nickel and Dimed, on Not Getting By in America. So once again, thank you all for coming out. Thank you, Barbara.
Thank you. I mean, I hope the title didn't mislead anybody. This is not a seminar in investment. Anyway, I'm just thrilled to see you all and actually to be back in Portland. I went to college at Reed. Anybody from Reed here? Hey, okay, yeah. Anyway, that was the days when I went there. It was a really hippie place. Is it still, I hope? Yeah. Okay. I was very lucky to find editors who were interested in having me do this kind of work, because I've spent a lot of time as a journalist trying to get stories about poverty, women in poverty, working people into the mainstream corporate media, and having a lot of rejections on that front. I'll tell you one anecdote that just sort of illustrates the attitude out there. This is a few years ago, and I was taken out to lunch by the editor of an important national magazine that will go unnamed in the interest of my future writing career, if any. And these lunches are very important to freelance writers. Very often the price of the lunch is greater than the fee you're going to get for the article. So, you know, you eat hearty. And I was pitching him an idea about a story on, it had to do with women and poverty, and I had a good angle, I had it all worked out, and he was so clearly uninterested, this guy. He's, you know, we're eating this gourmet food, and he's rolling his eyes over it. Finally, we get to the death by chocolate dessert and the decaf espressos. He said, okay, Barbara, do your thing on poverty, only make it upscale. So, you know, that's the kind of creative challenge you have in writing about these issues for the mainstream media. Now, here I was lucky to find, at first it was the editor at Harper's. This was originally a magazine story. It came up through a discussion with him about welfare reform. And we were just talking about how do they expect people coming off of welfare to get out there and, you know, get a job, entry-level job, and make enough money so suddenly you're lifted out of poverty and you can support your children and everything is fine. And I said, fool that I was, I said, you know, somebody at it, the math looks terrible, but since nobody believes it, somebody has to go out there and do the old-fashioned kind of journalism and try it for themselves and write about that. I didn't mean me, and he said, you, and anyway, that's how it started as a project and grew into a book project. So the idea was this, just to see if it was possible to live on the wages available to entry-level workers, which meant leaving home, finding the cheapest place I could to live in, and the best-paying job I could find, consistent with not using my actual resume. Not that I ever came across a Help Wanted ad for a political essayist anyway. So, and then the other, you know, then I had, of course, you know, do everything I could to hold on to that job. No goofing off. You know, I was going to give this the best try. And I should point out that I had a lot of advantages in doing this compared to many people who are in this not just as a short-term thing, but it's their lives. For example, I did not have two children with me, which would be the welfare average. Tried to get my children to come with me, but they weren't really interested in spending a month with mom in a trailer park or something. I'm strong, physically strong. I always had a car, and I did. You know, I just built that into the situation, a rent-a-wreck when I was not in, you know, in a place where I could use my own car or anything. And I'm white and speak pretty good English. And those, I think, are advantages, too, in getting jobs and probably in the kind of job you get. So I don't want to ruin the story for you if you, you know, I don't want to, you know, tell you the ending or anything. But as it turned out, it was very, very hard to make ends meet, even as a single person with those various sorts of advantages. You know, I knew before I went out to do this that if the wages were what they were looking like from the Help Wanted ads that I was seeing and the web and in the local paper, and rents were what I thought they would be, it was going to be really hard. As it turned out, it was almost impossible. I should probably say impossible with only one job. So this is really a book then about how hard you have to work to fail. I mean, how hard you have to work to remain in poverty. I'll tell you, you know, I worked in different jobs. I was a waitress. I'd already done that in high school and in college at different times. Hotel housekeeper, very briefly. A nursing home aide, a maid with a cleaning service, and a Walmart associate. There are no employees at Walmart. Everybody is an associate. I averaged in all these jobs $7 an hour. Let me just say a little bit about the Walmart job. That was kind of fascinating to me because, you know, this is the biggest private employer in the United States. This is huge. It's not really a corporation. It's a cult, in fact. It's not easy to get those jobs. You probably think, well, anybody can just walk in and get a job at Walmart. Oh, no. got to take a drug test. Well, you got to do that all over the place these days. A little ritual of humiliation, you know, please, will you pee for us? Anyway, pass that one. Then there's a personality test. Anybody here have to take a personality test for your job? Not many. I don't know why I get singled out, but so many of these low-wage jobs have personality tests. The Walmart one, you know, it's pretty easy. A lot of the questions are you can kind of guess, like this one. This is a guy, sort of a true or false thing. Quote, in the past year, I have stolen check dollar amount below worth of goods from my employers. You know, I got that one. And then there's this one. Quote, it is easier to work when you're a little bit high. I saw right through those. But actually, I got some wrong at Walmart. And this is so embarrassing to admit. See, my strategy was to give the right answer, but not so right that they could tell I was, like, faking out the test or I was a suck-up of some kind. No. So the one of the ones I got wrong was the proposition was all rules must be followed to the letter at all times. And I put strongly agree instead of totally agree. Because I didn't want to look like too much a suck-up. Anyway, the personnel manager came back from grading my personality by computer and said that was wrong. The answer is totally, all times. So you can never be too much of a suck-up at Walmart. I found that. I'm going to read a little section, though, from another part of my of this project, and this was from my life as a maid. This was the second place city I went to was Portland, Maine, where the first job I landed was with a house cleaning service. Now, I hadn't known about these things before. It's not like being an independent house cleaner, not like working with an agency even. You work in teams. It's very highly controlled what you do. You're taught how to do everything. You do everything from top to bottom, left to right, in just such and such a fashion. It's not like cleaning your own house at all. You wear very unflattering uniforms. And this was the most punishing job physically that I had. And I would say all the jobs that I had were physically extremely demanding. But this was the worst. At first, I was very proud of myself for keeping up even with the 20-year-olds until I realized that the reason why I could keep up was, in fact, that I hadn't been doing this for long. That they, even very young women, already had the repetitive stress injuries from the scrubbing motion, bad knees, and ruined backs from the job. So just to set the stage for this little scene I will read, it was an extremely hot day in early September, and we are cleaning Mrs. W's mansion. I say mansion. I don't know how to grade these things, really. But it was beyond McMansion. It was big. And my team leader that day, there were four of us in a team, and the leader was a woman I'll call Maddie, who was worried sick about her child care arrangement. She was paying $50 a week out of a paycheck of about $200 after taxes a week. For child care in a very jerry-rigged situation that she was nervous about. And the home we were cleaning belonged to a Mrs. W, who I learned a great deal about. When you clean people's houses, you do learn a lot about them. But she was an alumna of an important women's college who now devoted her time to monitoring her investments and the baby's bowel movements. And in fact, there were charts for this purpose, you know, printed charts. Consistency, time of day, color, on and on and on. Actually, she didn't have to fill that out. The nanny filled that out. But I dusted those charts, so I knew about them, too. But mostly the situation was that it was very, very hot. It is hotter inside than out, unair-conditioned for the benefit of the baby, I suppose. But I do all right until I encounter the banks of glass doors that line the side and back of the ground floor. Each one has to be Windexed, wiped, and buffed, inside and out, top to bottom, left to right, until it's as streakless and invisible as a material substance can be. Outside, I can see construction guys knocking back Gatorade. But the rule is that no fluid or food item can touch a maid's lip when she's inside a house. And by the way, we could be inside one house for 4 hours, and no drinking. Now, sweat, even in unseemly quantities, is nothing new to me, but in normal life, fluids lost are immediately replaced. Everyone in Yuppie Land, airports for example, looks like a nursing baby these days, inseparable from their plastic bottles of water. Here, however, I sweat without replacement or pause, not in individual drops, but in continuous sheets of fluid soaking through my polo shirt, pouring down the backs of my legs. The eyeliner I put on in the morning, vain twit that I am, has long since streaked down onto my cheeks, and I could wring my braid out if I wanted to. Working my way through the living rooms, plural, I wonder if Mrs. W. will ever have occasion to realize that every single doodad and objet through which she expresses her unique individual self is, from another vantage point, only an obstacle between some thirsty person and a glass of water. When I can find no more surfaces to wipe and have finally exhausted the supply of rooms, Maddie assigns me to do the kitchen floor. Okay, except that Mrs. W. is in the kitchen. So I have to go down on my hands and knees, practically at her feet. No, we don't have sponge mops like the one I use in my own house. The hands and knees approach is a definite selling point for corporate cleaning services like the maids. This is, by the way, not the Merry Maids, but the second largest one called the maids. We clean floors the old-fashioned way, on our hands and knees, the brochure that they give to customers boasts. A mop and a full bucket of hot soapy water would not only get a floor cleaner, but would be a lot more dignified for the person who does the cleaning. But it is this primal posture of submission that seems to gratify the consumers of maid services. I don't know, but Mrs. W.'s floor is hard. Stone, I think, or at least a stone-like substance. And we have no knee pads with us today. Now, I had thought, in my middle-class innocence, that knee pads were one of Monica Lewinsky's prurient fantasies. But no, they actually exist, and they're usually a standard part of our equipment. So here I am on my knees, working my way around the room like some fanatical penitent crawling through the Stations of the Cross, when I realize that Mrs. W. is staring at me fixedly. So fixedly that for a moment I am gripped by the wild possibility that I may once have given a lecture at her alma mater and that she's trying to figure out where she's seen me before. If I were recognized, would I be fired? More important, would she at least be inspired to offer me a drink of water? Because I've decided that if water is actually offered, I'm taking it, rules or no rules, and if word of this infraction gets back to the boss, I'll just say I thought it was rude to refuse. Not to worry, though. She's just watching that I don't leave out some stray square inch, and when I rise painfully to my feet again, blinking through the sweat, she says, "Could you just scrub the floor in the entryway while you're at it?" So that is a little glimpse of the worst job I ever had. A lot of the book is very much about the work. I think trying to get across that it's awfully hard work sometimes for very little money. That, by the way, was $6.63 an hour, that job. And you got bumped down to $6 an hour if you missed one day and stayed down there for 2 weeks, which was really a punishment for the mothers of small children, I thought. But this book is not only about the work. It's also about the people I worked with and got to know. People who did not have the escape hatch that I did, that is the chance to leave and go back to a comfortable home and a very rewarding and physically easy kind of job. People who made a very big impression on me, people like Gail and Joan, who got their real names, funny, fast-talking, very hard-working and generous women. In fact, these are women waitresses who would reach into their own pockets, into their own tip money, and buy a meal for someone who did not have money for themselves. And some, these are rather, grungy places we worked where there were very poor people sometimes. Then these two women, it turned out, were actually homeless. Although they didn't consider themselves homeless, in either case, one of them had a van, the other had a pickup truck to sleep in. And that is sort of above the level of homeless in some people's scale of things. Or people also here like Rosalie and Holly. women I worked with in the maid service, who it took me a long time to figure out were actually hungry during the working day. And it took me a long time to realize that they weren't just dieting when they didn't buy lunch or didn't bring lunch, that they didn't have the food and that they didn't have the money with them to buy anything. And people also, to mention one more, like George, one of the, it was a dishwasher, 19-year-old immigrant from the Czech Republic, who I got friendly with, and despite our language problems with each other, I learned that when he went back from his job, again, $6 an hour, he went to a dormitory into a bed that had just been vacated by another man who then went, you know, they shared beds, in other words, alternating with their shifts, which I thought was something that went on in the 19th century, not now. So there are not a lot of polemics in this book, unlike many some things I've written, but there is a message that I hope is strong. And, you know, put very simply, that is that there is something really wrong here when so many people, close to 30% of the workforce in this country, work so hard, you know, all the time, full time, and cannot get to the level of being able to live at any kind of comfort and decency for themselves and their children, and that we need some basic changes. Thank you. Okay, and we can have questions, we can have answers, yes, sir.
And you know this book has come out. Reveal what you were doing and who you were to the people you worked with.
The question is, did I ever reveal who I was and what I was doing to the people I worked with? Now, in each job, I would, at the end, toward the end, tell some person or people that I knew particularly well and felt close to, that I was actually not doing this for the money, and that I was in fact a writer, and that's why I was doing it. The response was to me very strange. You know, I was expecting shock, maybe anger, amazement. People were significantly underwhelmed, part of what I can figure out about that is that, I'd say I'm actually a writer. Well, most people are writers, you know, some of these people were writing poems or writing journals. One woman was writing a book. And so the typical response was, well, that's nice. Does this mean you're not going to be here next week for the evening shift? So, yes.
Would you say that an instructor to teach job skills and job readiness to people would say, to be realistic to people, when I face them in my classroom tomorrow?
Wow. Is that what he teaches job skills and job readiness to people coming off of welfare?
Among other people.
Among other people. And what should he tell them to be honest? Because there's no skill that isn't perishable, you know. I mean, that might not be outdated very soon or not necessary or something. You know, I think you should teach them how to organize. I should tell them what a union is, how to find one. Really. I mean, I would often bring that subject up, I mean, carefully, because you could get fired for using that word. But I would, maybe that's what we need here. And I found sometimes people didn't know what I meant, what that was. So that's what I would say to teach. Yes, sir.
Do you have a commitment beyond this work?
The question is, do I have a commitment beyond this book to these issues? Absolutely. The next project I'm working on is with Francis Fox Piven, who's an expert on welfare issues, is a book on what has actually happened since welfare reform and exploding the myth that everything, because we have some very disturbing data about that. So that's step one. But no, this is a long term commitment.
Mm-hmm.
Now he's pointing out that the new statistics show more renters for the first time than homeowners.
Hmm.
Okay, I had not seen that, and that's another indication of distress among large numbers of people. Yeah, I mean that's a thank you for pointing that out. Mm-hmm. Yes.
What has been the reaction from Walmart and some of the other companies?
I had no reaction from Walmart. I actually had one very surprisingly sweet reaction from the owner of one of these hotel and restaurants that I worked in. It was, you know, people could own, I guess, individual parts of big chain. These are all big chain things. And this guy, his wife was a liberal, turns out. And he wanted to have lunch with me. I said, no, coffee. No class collaboration, just coffee. And it was actually quite, I mean, in a sort of way touching. He promised to clean up the employee restroom in that place. No raising the wages or anything like that. But, if there's soap in that restroom, I will feel better. My life will not have been in vain. Yes, fell back there. The question was, have I kept in contact with some of the people I worked with? Insofar as possible, what has happened to some of those contacts is, you know, there's a lot of disruptions in people's houses, evictions or housing arrangements break down. So some of those contacts have not been easy to maintain. But I have kept, you know, I did send drafts of the relevant chapters to some people and just kept in some contact. Mm-hmm. Yes.
I'm just wondering if you see any hope in terms of organization. You mentioned that many of the people you talked to really didn't understand the concept of unionization. Obviously, there was a time in American history when people really identified themselves according to class and saw a kind of unity with other people who shared their fate. Did you see it? There was recently an article in The Nation about how many working class white men in the United States voted for George Bush. I'm just curious what you see in terms of organization of the people who you worked with for the future.
The question was, did I see evidences of class identification or solidarity among people I worked with? I really hesitate to generalize because, you know, I wasn't there to study those people, you know, or to, just really trying to see if I could do it. I saw very contradictory things. I saw people who seemed to me had a lot of solidarity who would, you know, you've got to, in a lot of these jobs, just to get by. I mean, there are jobs, for example, where there are no bathroom breaks. And so this is true, although that's not legal officially. So you've got to have people who are willing to kind of cover for you or to, you know, so you can sneak off. And there are all kinds of things like that where people really do depend on each other and solidarity is built in that way. And examples of generosity and sharing among people. I also saw people who seemed, you know, much, one person anyway, who seemed pretty confident that she was going to become rich in no time at all. But unfortunately, I think she's deluded in that case. Yes, the lady back there.
Can you talk about some of your living experiences? You talked about the work experience.
Good question. She asked for me to say something about my living, where I lived or how I lived. This was the part that I had not figured on how hard this was going to be. For example, in one place I rented a half-sized trailer. Now, half-sized trailer is pretty much living in a tin can. $625 a month without utilities. That's outrageous. Now, what in other places, I could not find any apartments. See, I had in my mind that maybe like 500 a month, 400 a month, I could get like a studio or a little efficiency, I'd be fine. There are no such things in many areas. I mean, I don't know anything much about housing, but the housing, affordable housing stock has just been shrinking in this country. It's either been destroyed, you know, in the name of some kind of urban renewal, or it's gobbled up, it's, you know, gentrified and taken up by wealthier people. So it's just not there. And so what people often end up doing, I learned, is live in residential motels. And this happens, for example, if you don't have enough money for first month rent and deposit. And see, I hadn't even thought of that. But there you are stuck paying by the week. So I lived in one of these places in Minneapolis, in the Minneapolis area, $250 a week. Ridiculous. No fridge, no microwave, no hot plate. Filthy. Unsafe. I mean, I was the worst motel in America. I nominated for that status, and everybody else in the place was, you know, also, you know, were low wage workers. I imagine the difference about me was that I had a room to myself. I was living in luxury. Whole families were living in rooms like mine, and if you have no place to cook, you're dependent on convenience stores and fast food, and then you know that's another huge expense. So that was like a big revelation to me how bad the housing situation is. I know. Yeah. Is there any sense of outrage coming from readers of the book? Well, it's only been out a couple of weeks, so I think the outrage is building, right? And there will soon be, you know, that would be great to inspire some outrage. Yeah, fellow back there.
Was that your experience today? This was maybe 6 years ago.
His saying that if you did, you ever hear him? Probably not. Hear him? People he worked with. We can't hear you. The people he worked with when he was working as a day laborer thought they were middle class and expected to do much better. Well, maybe they were very young in a lot of cases too. No? Okay. I didn't have that sense in most cases. I did work with people who would have defined themselves as poor, you know, if you gave them that choice. And actually, in studies show that if you give people the options middle class or poor, everybody's middle class usually, or most people will be. But if you give them working class, the picture changes. A lot of people will identify themselves as that. Yeah. Yes, the lady here. Okay, what about the education levels of people I worked with? I wasn't in a position to survey them, but, I would say that everybody seemed like a bright, articulate person. I imagine mostly high school graduates, maybe even a little bit of college in some cases. Yeah. Yes?
I heard you say in an interview that these low-wage workers are the great philanthropists of our society.
Okay, she said, she's asking for something that I have said in an interview. Actually, I just read a couple of lines because I said it maybe better here in the end of, at the very end of my book. When someone works for less pay than she can live on, when, for example, she goes hungry so that you can eat more cheaply and conveniently, then she has made a great sacrifice for you. She has made you a gift of some part of her abilities, her health, and her life. The working poor, as they are provingly termed, are in fact the major philanthropists of our society. They neglect their own children so that the children of others will be cared for. They live in substandard housing so that other homes will be shiny and perfect. They endure privation so that inflation will be low and stock prices high. To be a member of the working poor is to be an anonymous donor, a nameless benefactor to everyone else. As Gail, one of my restaurant co-workers, put it, you give and you give. So, I should point out they're involuntary philanthropists. And I'm sure that, yes, sir. Oh, I'm sorry.
Is any of the people that you associated with
Did any of the people I worked with have any interest in the political process? None that I ever saw. And part of the time was, did we have a presidential campaign before the last, before the presidential selection occurred? Didn't we have something? I mean, it was in the newspapers, but I never heard a person comment in any way on any of that. And I think the New York Times actually had an interesting article about that about a year ago, about low-wage people interviewing low-wage people, very rare for the New York Times, who don't vote. And they just had quotes from people saying, what difference does it make? They're not speaking to us. You know, they don't have anything for us. And whoever those guys who ran last time, I think that was really true. Anyway, well, I don't want to dwell on that subject of the presidency. Yes, you. The question is, how has the book been received, and particularly by upscale people like the magazine editor?
I'm trying to remember where I heard you on NPR.
Oh, Talk of the Nation. Yeah, I was there. I'm pleased and amazed that the reception has been very favorable. There's a kind of a mixed review in Newsweek this week. She didn't read it carefully enough. She says I'm against stay-at-home moms and Jesus. That is not true. You know, I mean, would I have been opposed to welfare reform if I was against stay-at-home moms, you know? And Jesus, I am a great fan of Jesus, you know. Remember, Jesus was he was a revolutionary. But anyway, and he gets a big plug in here, I think. And she completely missed that. Anyway, I don't want to dwell on that. Yes, sir.
I'm just wondering if you could say anything about the relationship of this book to some of your earlier work.
Okay, he's asking, how does this book relate to other books I've written in the past, and is it a different, is it targeted in a different way, like toward the more affluent people, targeted to them?
Do you see it just more important in some way to sort of kind of target a kind of middle class readership?
I can't say that as a writer that I think all that much about who I'm writing for. You don't control it all that much either. First of all, just the cost of a book limits you somewhat. And that's a real problem. That's very upsetting. But you can't, no matter how you work it, you can't control that. This was new for me and a departure from anything else I've ever written in being reporting. And if you've read my other books, they tend toward analytical or theoretical. Hey, Blood Rights, my most recent one book before, that's a complete theory of human nature. Explains all of prehistory and history in one volume, you know. And so this was, you know, complete departure, first-person reporting, and I didn't really have much sense of who would be interested in it or where it would be aimed at. Yes?
Do you have any commentary on the personal interaction between the supervisory or bosses and those who are working for them?
She asks, do I have any comment about the supervisory relationship? yes. Well, that began on like day two or day one when a coworker warned me that my purse could be searched at any moment by management. And I thought, this cannot be. And I went home and called a friend who's a union organizer, and he said, yes, that is legal, that is true. And I checked that since with. You have no rights in the low-wage workplace. It's true in the medium-wage workplace, too. You surrender your rights pretty much at the door. I mean, the privacy rights go, I think those personality tests, just like the drug tests, are an invasion of privacy to an extent, especially if they're going to ask questions like, do you suffer from moods of self-pity? Now, damn straight you suffer from moods of self-pity if you're applying for a $6 an hour job, you know, but it's none of their business. And then absurd rules, like that rule, no drinking water when you're working on a job. Walmart, no talking. Now, you know, well, you can say, where's the such and such, or have you done this and that? But no chatting or, you know, as, and when it's only normal and human to chat with somebody when you have a few moments. And so you have to sneak to do that. Now, there are nice managers, you know, nicer people and sadistic managers. But the overall tone of the corporate workplace today for low-wage people is like a penitentiary in some ways. Not, and I don't mean to be in any way belittle the extremes to which penitentiary life goes, but in the sense that you do not have your rights as a citizen there, freedom of speech or the rest of it. And I think that is a major obstacle to anybody doing anything about their situation, because you can be fired for anything. You know, being a troublemaker, you're out. The AFL-CIO estimates 10,000 people a year are fired for union activity. And that would just, I'm sure that just scratches the surface. There's a man in the very, very back. Yes, the question is, are unions doing anything and are they addressing themselves? I wish they were doing more, but, you know, I also understand much better than I ever did what the obstacles are and the kind of intimidation and that goes on in these workplaces. However, I did have one very, very thrilling event. This is an anecdotal answer. On this book tour, I went to Minneapolis last week, which is where I had worked at Walmart, and participated in a labor rally held by United Food Commercial Workers, SEIU, AFSCME, the Farmers Union, and who else was there? ACORN, the Poor People's Organization, and the Welfare Rights Group. One big rally with all these groups, and I gave my little talk, and rank and file people stood up, and the union, United Food and Commercial Workers, announced that it's launching a drive at Walmart. So, that was just a thrilling thing to participate in. Yes, right there.
They say, well, clearly people are because they're not dying in the streets. You know, they're not going so hungry that they just collapse. They're not getting so sick that they're just, you know, falling on people's doorsteps. I thought, of course, that was stupidly cynical, but I would like to hear your response to that.
Mm-hmm. Did you hear what she said? She said that my book was criticized in Salon.com. Ha, they won't be long for this world. Without any help from me, you know. No, it's an interesting publication. I sometimes read it. But that I was criticized because what the reviewer said, and I don't remember, I just skimmed it, was that people are not dying in the streets and that people are getting by. Yeah. Yeah.
It's
stupider
than
they actually Well, all I can say is... I see the world differently from having done this. You know, I was always socially conscious, radical, and everything. I see things I did not see before. You know, now when I see that woman standing behind the counter in the food mart in the gas station, I have a thought about how many hours she spent on her feet. You know, I have a question about what she goes home to, if it's a home, what sort of situation her kids have been in all day. You know, I see that. I ask those questions that I might not have had. Before I might have said, hey, she's alive. She's on her feet. She's not, you know, begging or fainting or anything. And I see pain that I didn't see before. And I would say I define it as my responsibility as a journalist to make pain visible. Because that's the only way we're going to change, is to make it visible. Yes, right.
I was wondering if you drew any conclusions about capitalism from your experience. It seems pretty obvious that it's an economic system that cannot employ everybody. And also, do you have some aspirations for kickstarting the feminist movement to really take on grappling with what welfare, so-called welfare reform, has done to women's lives, because it sounds like what the system, the economic system, being in decline is falling most harshly on women. Women are bearing the brunt of bad economic times. And so I'm wondering if you had any comments on that.
Could you hear what she said back there? No. Okay. Have I any thoughts on capitalism and whether it's responsible and to what extent? And you threw in that obviously capitalism doesn't generate enough jobs for everyone. And then, and what about, aren't women taking the brunt of some of these problems? And with how to make welfare reform and welfare issues or low-income women's issues more central to the feminist movement? Whoa, big questions.
And what solutions do you
have? And what solutions?
I'll throw that in.
Hey, throw that in. Why not, you know? Well, let me say this about capitalism. There are capitalist countries that do much better. I would not hesitate to throw the blame entirely on capitalism, but we do need to understand that, say, Northern European countries, for example, do not, you know, they provide much better social services, they have stronger unions, they, you know, it's possible to have capitalism and not this degree of social segregation by class, economic segregation, whatever has happened. That's a short answer to that, is that something has gone awry. We have some sort of bandit capitalism here, or perhaps, you know, increasingly globally, which just treats workers as a renewable resource and has very little interest in their survival. You mentioned unemployment. I want to emphasize that we have nearly full employment. I certainly did a few months ago, and I heard for so many decades on the left and from liberals that when you get full employment, all problems are solved. You know, that everybody will rise, wages will rise. Not true. Because there are non-market forces. I mean, it should be that way, right? Supply, demand. It should work that way. I mean, I would apply for jobs, you know, where they were begging for people, and then they're offering you $6 and change for pay. Doesn't make sense. Something else is going on. The, you know, American corporate management has, you know, more or less made the decision that wages are not going to rise. You know, I mean, that they'll fight. You know, the market will not work for wages. So it's not a matter of just unemployment or employment anymore when you have jobs that pay so little. And as for welfare reform and welfare issues, yes, I very much would like to see these be central issues for feminists of all social classes and all races. You know, because my idea of feminism has always been, it's not just feminism for some women, it's feminism for all women, and that means you start with who's hurting. And that may be a middle-class woman because she faces violence or whatever the problem is, but it's day in, day out, it is definitely poor women and women of color and so on. So, yeah. Let me see. You had your hand up. Yeah. She asked whether the people who interviewed me for these jobs ever thought I was an unusual applicant or asked me questions. The embarrassing answer is no. You know, I wish just once in this experience someone had said, you know, Barb, you're really kind of special. Never, never happened. The only way in which I was as special was that I was so inexperienced, you know, at every job. What I said in job applications is that I'm a divorced homemaker reentering the workforce. And that is true as far as it goes, right? I mean, divorced homemaker. And as a freelance writer, I haven't had a job for a long, long time. So, you know, no, there was no interest and curiosity in any of that. And I did put down Reed College, too. They probably thought, oh, yeah, probably, you know, beautician school somewhere. Yes?
I don't know. I'm, I am a landlord.
Yes.
And I thought your book was unforgettable. I'll never forget it. And that is not the solution. What do you think?
But why not? I mean, the government used to be involved. I mean, the government used to be involved in many more ways, and it has cut, they've cut back their involvement more and more in housing subsidies, in building affordable housing. You know, I don't see why not.
Well, I used to live next to a project, and is that any indication?
Well, yeah, I mean, not that kind of public housing, but I mean, subsidies, something. Yes, I agree. I mean, the housing is a place where the market works real well. But to the detriment of people without much money. I mean, it's, you know, drives up rents, obviously. Well, I was just saying rent control hurts people more than it helps. I don't know, but removing rent control seems to hurt a lot, too. So it's a, I don't know the, I'm not really a policy wonk on housing issues. I think we have time for a couple more. Yes, one right here. Do I have any skills?
Guilt.
Do I have any guilt coming from a position of relative privilege and seeing this misery around me? Not so much guilt as anger is what I felt. You know, I would say that was my overwhelming feeling. But, you know, where do you draw the line? I mean, I think about it. My jeans are from the Gap. The Gap has been known to use sweatshop labor. I mean, in so many areas of our lives now, and I really think it's great that we have this student anti-sweatshop movement and everything, bringing these things to our attention. We've got to go beyond being paralyzed, you know, by guilt and think, well, what do we do? Because now, you know, I think thanks to that student movement and other things and church activities and so on, we're beginning to see the people behind the product in many areas. And the response has got to be with organizing and activism. Let me see. Who's had their hand up the longest? That woman next to leaning against the wall. We put a lot of blame on the people who are in these situations rather than addressing the problems. And you worked where?
Oregon Food Bank.
And it was in on discussions about welfare reform and how people were supposed to budget. Hey, what could be more comforting, though, to wealthy people than to say that this is what's wrong with the poor and that's why they're poor? It's because they're stupid. That was the goal. Remember the bell curve? That they're stupid, or that they're lazy and self-indulgent, and they don't know how to budget, and everything. I mean, it's very self-comforting, I think, for people who are very affluent to do that, and it protects you from ever having to face those unpleasant realities.
I guess my question is, mm-hmm.
How do we break through that? I guess just by continually raising these issues, continually confronting them with truths, hard truths. Mm-hmm. Okay.
Thank you very much, Barbara. I'll just get this area cleared out. It'll just take me about 1 minute, and then Barbara can sign books here. So thank you all for coming. Thank you, Barbara.